Well, hello. Welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. We've been around for about 50 years, and it's still only $5 admission. If you haven't paid, please see David Drum back in the back. Please also remember that if you are eating, that when your food bill comes, pay your waitress, and also leave her a nice tip. Zoe does a wonderful job for us here. So we are thankful for her. Let's see. We will have a lecture tonight that will last roughly 45 minutes, and there will be time for Q&A afterwards. Please, if you ask a question, make it a question. We've got one speaker here. We don't need another 45-minute lecture after this one. Tonight's speaker is Dr. George James from the University of North Texas. He's an authority on the history and philosophy of religion, particularly in the areas of South Asian religion and early Christianity. He has an MA in religion from Eastern Nazarene College and a PhD in religion from Columbia University. He's published 3 books on these topics, is the author of over 16 papers and 16 encyclopedia articles on everything from atheism to the Swadhyapa. Swadhyaya. Isn't that even worth it? Yeah, right. Movement. He's a member of the American Academy of Religion, the International Society for the Study of Religion, Nature, and Culture. One area of particular interest to him has been the connections between environmentalism and cultural religious movements, especially in India. Tonight he will be talking about environmental movements, nonviolence, and deforestation. So please help me welcome Dr. George James.
It's a great pleasure to be with you tonight. It's not my first experience talking to this group. It's not my first. But I think the last time I spoke to this group was 4 years ago. And it's always interesting to be with you because I have to be at the table before I can start. Before I start, I'm just going to comment on a couple of things that I've encountered in the last week that I found engaging. One was a New York Times article about the condition of the environment in India. Particularly it's concerned with water. India is known largely as a place where there are floods and there are droughts because water management has been a challenge to the country. Another thing that was brought to my attention by was a new series of videos that are being sold to evangelical newsletters called Battling the Green Monster. And the Green Monster is a code word for environmentalism in general. I just taught a course called Reference Religion and the Environment, and to look at the history of Christianity and how Christianity has related to the environment over time. And it was interesting to me because we did look both at liberal Christians and conservative Christians. And I invited my students to learn about both conservative approaches to the more liberal approaches to the environment and the standpoint of religion. And what I didn't know is that there is a very active reactionary group within Protestant Christianity, particularly evangelical Christianity, that regards regard for the environment as fundamentally suspicious. And that it's likely...
It didn't say that.
Good. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the comment. made, so I think there's a comment there. I'm still hearing some feedback here.
I can't turn it up too much.
Can you turn down the bass?
There's always so much you can have.
Is that mic on?
Yeah, it's on. It's just.
Turn that mic off. That's the problem. Just turn it off.
See if that helps.
Go ahead.
Okay, so I am one of those members of the Green Dragon that actually believes that religion and environmentalism are compatible. And the reason that I came to that is not from the cultural Christianity perspective, but from my encounters with environmental issues in India. And this began around the year 1990, when I discovered that my department was turning to environmentalism, largely because philosophy departments were under threat. And we had to do something that would make us relevant. So focusing on environmental philosophy seemed a reasonable strategy. And it's turned out to be very fruitful because in the course of time, since 1990, I have seen a great deal of changes in that field as it has developed. We were concerned to begin with about issues like instrumental value as opposed to inherent or intrinsic value of nature. And there was a debate about that for about 10 years. And then the question about other religions and the environment became an issue. So people were very interested in exploring what religions were more eco-friendly than others. And of course, having just begun to study Hinduism, I was particularly interested in the way Hinduism related to the environment as opposed to the way Western religion related to the environment. That seems to help.
Let's keep going.
In any case, I had been to India a couple of times by the year 1990, and I thought it would be interesting to look at environmental issues, environmental philosophy, environmental ethics, in the light of another cultural setting. And so at that time, I got a faculty development leave and a faculty research grant and went to India for a semester to examine environmental issues. And I wasn't interested in environmental issues too long before I started understanding the importance of environmental movements. And I discovered that if you really want to see how Hinduism relates to the environment, you need to look at these environmental movements. Because that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where the belief system actually has an impact on the way people see it. I discovered that since independence, and even before independence, there have been an enormous number of environmental movements in India. And these movements were not particularly concerned about global climate change, or preserving wild areas for future generations, or species extinction. They were concerned about their own survival. And one of the movements that I found particularly interesting and one that got a good deal of attention among scholars, I think it's called the Chipko movement. Chipko is a Hindi word. It's also known as Garhwali, which is the region north of Delhi, if you have a sort of mental picture of India, and north and west of Delhi, Western Himalayas. Now, the Himalayas are not just snow-capped mountains. There are a lot of forest areas in the Himalayas, and there are people who live in those forest areas. Since British times, that area had been exploited rather deeply by the forest industry because other forest areas of India had been pretty well exhausted by that time. The Malabar coast had been a forest area that was of interest to foresters and to the forest industry, but that when that area became stressed, we discovered that the Western Himalayas was a area that had a great deal of potential for timber. And the timber, of course, was needed for the construction of railway ties, for the construction of railways, to expand the economy of the country. And basically, their attitude was that it was an inexhaustible resource. what they didn't recognize and what they didn't take any interest in was the people of the forest, people of the Himalayas, who also depended upon the forest for their livelihood. In fact, one of the persons that I'll be talking about very shortly is a man named Sundarlal Bahugana. He was one of the most visible figures in the Chipko movement. And when I first talked to him, he wanted me to understand the 5 S, meaning the 5 things that forest people depend upon when it comes to the forest. And they were food, fodder for the cattle, fiber, fuel, and fertilizer. Of course, a person who is interested in the forest industry is interested mainly in timber. These non-timber forest products are also very important for the local people. And so the traditional economy of the hills was animal husbandry with light agriculture, largely to feed the cattle. And it depended upon a great deal of biodiversity within the region. The British, particularly the British foresters, were interested only in the timber, because that's what was needed for the expansion of British civilization in India. So their procedure was to auction large portions of forests to corporations who would send their own crews in to cut down the trees and basically clear cut the region and extract it without any concern for reforestation such as we have in this country, particularly in the region that I'm from, Western Canada, with British Columbia. Now, you would think that this process would change with independence. Once the British are expelled and the Indian government was able to establish its own hegemony, you would think that the tiller would be returned to the land would be returned to the tiller, and that the forest would be returned to the people. But this is not the way it happened. After independence, the forest industries that had already been established during British times still continued to operate. And the forest departments of the various states, particularly in the north, became the largest landholder of India. And so the ownership of land shifted, but the industries continued to develop. And so the period following, and in fact even before independence, was a period in which there was continuous conflict between the British foreign forest policy and the needs of the local people. So that the local people were restricted from going into the forest to gather things that they needed from the forest for their own well-being, while corporations were auctioned, in fact, large stands of timber for their economic and civilizational purpose. So conflicts continued largely between administration and people. The Chipko movement comes from the word Chipko, which means to hug. And so these people were the original tree huggers. That's a term that is used in kind of a derogatory way, but they literally did hug the trees in order to save them from the axe. It does raise the question of why a person would put his life on the line to save the forest. And the answer is that the forest is the livelihood of the people. And so if the forest is gone, their life is endangered. Their life is basically over. In the conflict that is known as the Chipko movement, and I'll just show you a couple of slides here if I may. First of all, I should tell you that I'm going to be talking about 2 areas here. One is in this region here of Uttarakhand, which is in the northern region of India, a very heavily forested region. I'm going to be talking a little bit about another movement that is derived from that in this area called Karnataka. The person that is most visible in the Chipka movement was this man named Sundaral Bhutada. And he's the one that talked about the five F's. He was also a man of great integrity and a person who really put his life on the line to save the forest by undertaking fasts to draw the people's attention, the government's attention, to the threat to the local people that was posed by the forest industry. I've only got about 12 slides to show you, so I'd like to just leave this one on for a while and come back to that. So Chipko was a movement to save the forest from nuclear felling. And it really points out a contrast between two worldviews. One that was established by the colonial government, and the other that is inherent in what is today called traditional ecological knowledge, something that we've only derived a real understanding of in fairly recent years, but it's a subject that is of very great interest among persons who are interested in philosophy of the environment and environmental ethics. I also need to point out that the inspiration for this movement came largely from Gandhi. Gandhi was not only a freedom fighter who opposed British hegemony in India, he was also an economist. And his understanding of the economy was very different from the British understanding of the economy and the maintenance of that economy. Gandhi believed that every village should be independent, that it should be self-reliant in terms of its food, its clothing, and its shelter. That's very different from our way of thinking of an arrangement with the land. So if the forests of the Himalayas were going to be independent, they would need both to support the forests that they depend upon for their existence and find ways of making a living from the forest. So the first issue that I think is important is the influence of Gandhi. The second is ecology. And Sundaral Bhutada was very much a student of ecology. I was very interested in how different aspects of an ecosystem fit together and how one is dependent upon another. And the third thing is the Hindu religious tradition, particularly the religious traditions of the village people themselves. Because for most people, every feature of nature is understood to be a manifestation of the divine reality. Sometimes rivers are referred to as goddesses because they are bodies that we are dependent upon. Mountains are also divine realities. Forests are divine realities. So these things are very important for understanding the Chipko movement. Now the Chipko movement was particularly occupied with forest resources. And Sundaral Bhutada and others who he was associated with were instrumental in establishing what were called, I'll give you one example, the Sholi Gram Swarajya Sangh. That is, Sangh, which was a council. Swarajya means self-rule. And so they would put the name of the village in front, and then they would add the words, Gram, which is village, Swarajya Sangh. So village, independent, council. And so there were different songs of this nature in different regions of the Western Himalayas, and they all had quite an impact. Their concern was to enable, you see, the way the British had done it is they would take forest crews from the plains or other places and bring them to the forest to undertake the work of clear cutting the forest. The local people felt that there is work to be done in the forest. There is income to be made from the forest, but it could be made in a sustainable way. The difficulty, of course, is the people coming down the forest were not from the region. They didn't have any sense of the importance of that forest resource for the local people. So what the Chipko movement wanted to do first was to establish what was called labor cooperatives. They would organize themselves into laboring entities, and they would compete with others for tracts of land that they could sustainably fell and produce, timber brush. Not only timber, but also turpentine, which was at that time a great industry. The cheer pine, which was a very common tree in the forest, was tapped. And most of the turpentine that we ever got when I was growing up, it came from India. It came from the cheer pine, and so the tapping of the cheer pine was something that the British was also involved with. The local people felt, well, they could be involved in this industry and do it in a sustainable way, not just clear cutting and overexploiting the trees, but not actually using them for one's own benefit. So this was called the economic phase of the Chipko movement. The economic phase of the Chipko movement finally yielded to another development, because people like Sundarlal Nehru came to the realization that trees are important and trees need to be preserved standing. And his view was that if we are going to cut down the trees, it doesn't matter whether a labor cooperative is cutting down the trees or workers from the corporation are cutting down the trees. It is going to be bad for the economy if those trees are exploited. Now, of course, the labor cooperatives wanted to use those resources sustainably, but there's always pressure to overexploit. So he took a step that separated him from some of his colleagues by arguing that the trees should be used for their own fruit, their own fodder, for their own fiber, fuel, yes, occasionally, fertilizer is another thing. It's interesting to me to walk in forests, even in Texas. There's a place that I go to walk and meditate, and I go there almost every Saturday that I can, and I see it from time to time over the years, and I've seen it over the years. It's interesting to me how when the lake, Lake Louisville, rises, and there's a storm, and it carries a lot of debris into the forest, and that finally dissipates, and you see a lot of forest debris that is gradually being reduced to soil. City if you look at it over time. So they recognize that the forest is both the source of soil and the source of food. So it's interesting that in the conflict between the forest administrators and the local people, particularly women, there was one occasion when a forest worker was trying to explain to the women the importance of the forest industry for them. And he said, "Don't you know what the forests bring us? They bring us timber, resin, and foreign exchange." And their reply was, what the forests bring us is soil, water, and pure air. They understood that pure air comes from the trees, and that this is what they wanted to preserve. Well, this movement has been of interest to historians of religion and to ecological historians for some time, and a lot has been written about it. Less has been written about another movement, and movements that have been influenced by the Chipko movement. And the one that I would like to turn to now is in the south of India, and it is in the state of Karnataka. And the principal exponent of that is this man, Pandurang Hegde, who is a very close personal friend of mine, probably the person who knows me better than anybody else on this planet, because we spent so much time together in the forest, and in the forest we do a lot of talking, so we're very close friends. He was a student of social work at Delhi University, and part of his training that is required of master's degree students at the University of Delhi in social work is to go and do work with a social worker of some renown. And so he chose to go and work for Sunderlal Mahugadal. By the way, I should point out that Sunderlal Mahugadal, as you saw that picture we took quite a long time ago, was quite elderly, but that picture was very good. He is now 92 years old, and he is going to be turning 93, God willing, on January the 9th. Normally, I've been with him on his birthday for the last several years. I'm not going to be there this time because I've just had some dental work that that's me from traveling internationally for a while. But it's he was a very interesting person. Pandurang Hedi went to work with him and then went to work for Oxfam, which is a British aid agency, in Madhya Pradesh. And then he happened to be making a trip back to his home village in Karnataka and observed that there was a great deal of devastation of the forest right there. And he discovered that there was a plywood plant that had been in place and that the forest would be cut in the region of his own village. And so he became involved in a movement that was already underfoot to oppose that kind of development. He also opposed the development of monocultures because it was recognized that teak was a cash crop and that teak had great value. And so the idea is that teak and eucalyptus were crops that would justify the clear cutting of the natural forests of that region and replacing them with monocultures, largely because of the capital that they brought. And again, it neglected the needs of the local people. So, the Chipkot movement was concerned first about forest welfare, but after this movement got going, there was another crisis that was brought to the attention of Sunderlal Mahugadal, and that he really had to attend to. He sees it, as he says, as a parenthesis in his career to save the Himalayas. And that was the construction of an enormous hydroelectric power project near the city of Terry in the western Himalayas. And that was going to be the largest dam in Asia, and it was going to be over 200 meters in height. And it was going to be on the Bhagirathi River, which is the northernmost tributary of the Ganges River. And it was an area that was very vulnerable to earthquakes. It's a seismically active region. And so it was felt, both by Mahugadal and by his associates, that this technology was inappropriate for that place. And secondly, it was coming at an enormous cost to the local people, who would, 100,000 people would have been displaced, would be displaced by the Terry Dam. That was a considerable crisis. So his attention turned to the Terry Dam, and for over 15 years, there was a continuous protest against the development of this dam. One of the things about this dam that was interesting is that it was intended to bring drinking water, fresh water, to the city of Delhi. The city of Delhi, of course, had been founded in the 14th century by the Mughals because of the waters. It was an area that was rich in water because of the Yamuna River that flowed through the Delhi, Delhi. And it was an interesting area because it was very rich in resources. What has happened over the course of time, both during British times and since, is that that river has been diverted to barrages for irrigation canals, and there's a great deal of effluents from industries that are on the banks of the Yamuna River that are pouring their waste into the Yamuna River. And so today, and by the way, there's a lot of talk about the pollution of the Yamuna River in Delhi that's largely attributed to the poor people who established these unofficial colonies on the banks of the river. But the fact of the matter is that 80% of the pollution going into the Yamuna River is from high-rise apartments among the middle-class neighborhoods, where the wastewater from toilets goes straight into the Yamuna River. So the recall of the chipmunk about this was that Kelly has so devastated the Yazuri River that it is now wanting the Guadarati River to provide for its water needs. So this became an extremely, extremely contentious issue. And there was a case brought to the Supreme Court called a public litigation brief to the Supreme Court, and eventually the Supreme Court sided with the Terry Development Corporation, and the band went forward. The Apiko movement, and Apiko means to hug in the language of Karnataka, which is called Kannada, not to be confused with the country I'm from, Kannada. And it's interesting that this movement was inspired by the same issues that were inspired by, that inspired the Chipko movement, but it became much more diverse. While the Chipko movement, just because of historical circumstance, was focused on forest welfare and the significance of the trees, and then the Chipko, then the Terry Dam, the Apiko movement became much more diverse and was concerned with ecological issues on a variety of levels. So, for instance, there was a paper mill in Karnataka, near the West Coast, called the West Coast Paper Mill. And it was, as it had been for years, pouring its effluents into a river called the Kali River that the people downstream are dependent upon for their water supply. And so those people, of course, were up in arms about this this paper mill that was disregarding their own welfare. And so this movement was concerned about that. They were also concerned about the development of a nuclear power plant that was not useful, not particularly indicated for the needs of the local people. There were a number of other issues as well. They were concerned about that. They were concerned about a dam on a river in that region, and they managed to get that construction of a hydroelectric power project stopped. They were also concerned about a railway that was intended to go through the virgin forest of the Western Ghats. And they felt that this was just ecologically unsustainable and inappropriate for that region. And so they were protesting that. And they've been involved with a number of issues of that nature. There's one that I want to focus on because it's particularly interesting in light of a crisis that we are all vaguely aware of, and that is the crisis of the honey industry. One of the interesting things about my career is that I've been able to dabble in a lot of different issues, and I think a person simply trained in philosophy and teaching philosophy in the language analytic tradition would never get into. So I learned a lot about city culture from my exploration of forest issues in the Western Himalayas. I suddenly had to learn a lot about apic culture in Karnataka and around the world, because this issue that arose in Karnataka. Bee cultivation or apiculture goes a very long way back in Indian civilization. The Rig Veda, the first, the earliest documents of the Hindu religious tradition, talked frequently about the importance of honey. Frequently. And they talk about the fact that a person who eats honey is going to be strong, he's going to be well developed mentally, and he's going to be happy. And not only that, he will be beautiful, and his children will be beautiful as a result. Indicates that honey was important. It's also interesting that Krishna, Lord Krishna, who appears most prominently in the Bhagavad Gita, is called Madhava, which means born of honey. So honey is a very, very ancient, and bee culture is a very ancient aspect of Indian civilization. I should also point out that there is a great deal of diversity of bees in India. There's basically one or two bees that are known in America. One is the Apis mellifera that we get all our honey from. And the other is that large bumblebee that you sometimes see on TV, but for much, they're not domesticated. But in India, there are 2015, there's a publication that indicated how many varieties of bees there are in India. There's over 250 varieties of bees. I'm only going to talk about two of them today, because one of them is so inherent in the life of the culture that it is really the hallmark of a kind of culture that has sustained the people and that has enabled people to have honey in a sustainable way. Let me just go to a couple more slides here. This is Sundara Bhugana and Chandra and Higgity together honeybee tree. This is the Apis mellifera. This is the honeybee that you'll see on any flower in Texas today. That has originated in Europe, probably originally came from Africa, but it was imported to India in the 17th century, and from America it spread to many other countries in the world, including China, and recently to India. It is the most productive bee in the world. It is especially bred for the production of honey, and produces more honey per colony than any other bee. But it's one of the many bees of India. In fact, it's only been introduced to India fairly recently. The other bee that is known in India, and by the way, this is a mellifera bee box that is quite expensive for local people to use. And this is the Apis serrata, which is about two-thirds the size of our American bee. And it doesn't produce as much honey. The honey is a little bitter and a little darker, very sweet and very, very flavorful. And it is sustainable. So the Apis mellifera is the more productive honeybee. And it is the honeybee that a lot of people think of when they think of honey. It's also interesting that there is a crisis in America, as well as other countries, about the Apis mellifera. You probably noticed that bees are dying. You may have heard that. There is a crisis in America now that has also been seen in India called colony collapse disorder. It can be caused by a variety of things, and sometimes you don't know just what it is that is causing it. But bees are dying in great numbers, both in America and in Europe. The Apis serrata, this bee, is native to India, and it has been cultivated for millennia in India. And in the 1920s and 30s, when Gandhi was establishing local village industries, he supported the use of the Apis serrata as a bee to produce honey sustainably. So it is sustainable, is the interesting thing. Now, the Apis mellifera is an interesting bee. It's interesting to compare it to something else that is interesting to agriculturalists, and that is the Holstein cow, which, as you know, or may know, is the largest producer of cow of any species of cow in the world. And it's interesting to me that that cow is being imported to India. And I have friends who have told me that in order to maintain that cow, you have to have air-conditioned cow chickens because the temperature is too high for them. But there's a great deal of appeal to it because it produces more milk than any cow. Likewise, the Apis mellifera is a bee that not only the Indian government, but the FAO of the UN, the Food and Agricultural Organization of the UN, has pushed in the third world, particularly in India. And they have encouraged people who have been using the Apis serrata for years to switch over to the more productive Apis mellifera. Now, the difficulty is that Atlas Calebra requires a large area of forage that has to be close to the hive. So in places like Punjab and Madhya Pradesh, perhaps, the Atlas Calebra has done fairly well. However, it is much more expensive to manage. It requires some technical expertise. It requires a person trained in the treatment of mites that are a continuous problem for beekeepers. It has to eat 4 kgs of sugar syrup just to get a colony started, and it is very expensive. By contrast, the Apis cerana, which is the local native bee, can travel many, a great deal of distance in the forest to find flowering plants. It is naturally resistant to mites. It doesn't need any sugar syrup to get it started, and it can survive on a minimum of food, whereas the Apis cerana, if it doesn't have foraging areas close by, the whole colony dies. Now, in the 1990s, there was a crisis in India about the Apis cerana that also affected the Apis cerana. In fact, in 1991, the state of Karnataka had produced 350,000 kgs of honey per year. In the year 1998, it was down to 10,000 kgs per year. So it's a significant loss of honey income. Moreover, it was a crisis for other things as well, and it continues to be a crisis for America, because about one-third of the human diet comes from plants, which are pollinated by insects, and 80% of the and 80% of them are pollinated by the honey. So it is a crisis that is going on in the world, and it is a crisis that has occurred in India as well. And so the apical movement was interested in addressing this issue as well. And as I said, the Apis mellifera is a highly specialized, selectively bred bee for maximizing the production of honey, and therefore a problem. The Apis cerana is a bee that is simply much more adapted to the environment. And so the cultivation of the Apis cerana has been extremely important for villages, and it has been sustainable. So the apical movement moved to address this issue. And of course, you don't get anything done when it comes to ecology by yourself. So they formed an organization which undertook certain resolutions. One was to create awareness about farmers of apiculture as a way of supplementing their income. They resolved to formulate floral calendars so they could keep track of when each flowering plant would be in bloom, so that there would be a steady resource of flowers for the bees to visit. And they also developed queen bee breeding centers in disease-resistant areas. And they also undertook honey festivals to make people aware of the importance of honey and the potential of honey as a source of food. It's interesting that the whole idea of switching to the Apis mellifera was motivated by the international reputation of India as being a place where food is scarce. And so any measure to increase food productivity tended to be appreciated by those in power, particularly those in government. But they didn't recognize the importance of the bee in terms of the ecosystem that it exists in. It's interesting that bee cultivation in the Western Himalayas, the Western Ghats, it has been going on for millennia, and it has always been a sustainable source of income for the local people. So the final resolution of this group that focused on this issue was to undertake honey festivals in villages and bring people to the awareness of the availability of honey cultivation as a means of supplementing one's income and of providing food that would also be sustainable. So these are, and so it's interesting that what happened following this, as I said, in 1998, there was an extremely low output of honey in the region. But following that, in fact, in the year 2003, it was reported that honey production had begun to rebound, particularly in the state of Karnataka and in other places where the local bee is being used. So the idea is that there is a kind of traditional ecological knowledge that is different from the ecological knowledge and the technology that we have produced as a culture that may not be useful in local situations. And so India has largely begun to address that crisis, the crisis that we are encountering here, by returning to a traditional strategy for beekeeping, for agriculture, which is part of a whole understanding of the world that we are now beginning to understand as historians of ecology and philosophers of ecology. We can see that the traditional ecological knowledge of people who have lived in a region for a very long period of time have evolved themselves, have evolved strategies to make a living in that region, maybe more sustainable than the highly technical, specialized methods that are so important to us. And with that, I will stop. I'm going to take any questions you might have.
As the keeper of the microphone, I get the first question. I want to kind of follow up on what you were saying last. India now has 15% of the world's population, roughly. Is it feasible to support that many people with sustainable agricultural methods? I mean, we in this country depend on heavy mechanization and oil-based fertilizer and so forth. We have a surplus of food, but that won't last forever. Do you think that this is sustainable in the long term?
Well, I think that a lot of the ecological problems that India is now facing is a result of the misappropriation of Western technology. So, for instance, I have visited areas in South India where I have seen people harvesting grain the traditional way that you even hear referred to in the Bible, you know, throwing the grain into the air so that the wind will drive away the chaff and the remaining head. And that is labor intensive, but it is sustainable. And my friend Pandu, Pandu Hegedu, was telling me, look at this and see that this is sustainable. These people can make a living this way. But there's no money available for that kind of agriculture. There's no payment for local people to undertake that. There's an enormous number of people out of work that could be employed that way. I think that traditional agriculture simply hasn't been given a chance to manage. You know, we still live under the impression that India is a starving country. It's really not. But I think that a lot of our agricultural problems there are a result of the use of chemical fertilizers that deplete the land. I could give another example of high-yield rice, which was being pushed 20 years ago and resulted in conditions that were not favorable to the yield of people. For instance, in order to do this and use this high-yield rice, people had to buy the seed from the company that was selling it. They also had to invest in machinery because the rice was not high enough to cut the second one in half. So they would then go into debt in order to get the goods that they needed to harvest this rice this way. And by the way, there is in India today an enormous crisis of suicide among farmers because they are so far in debt because of these strategies that they have tried to appropriate from the West. And what is the rest getting at? They are selling products to the third world. And so corporations are making a lot of money, but the local people are not helping them. So I'm not saying that's the whole answer, but that's a good part of it.
No other questions?
I was struck by one thing you said very early on about what people in your department and other ecological philosophers talk about, and whether it's a sort of a useful utilitarian value of the economy, of the ecology, or an intrinsic value of the ecology. It seems like everything you've said is about the usefulness for people. And
yeah. Well, I'm glad you asked that, because there's another term that got thrown around a lot in early discussions of environmental ethics, and that is anthropocentric approaches rather than biocentric approaches. Now, the word anthropocentric can mean a lot of things. Lynn White, famous historian of ecology, argued that our ecological crisis is a result of Christian values, if you will, Christian tradition, because it is the most anthropocentric tradition on the face of the earth. Well, the presumption is that anthropocentric means that you're concerned with the instrumental value of things. Now, I would say that in India, people are concerned with the instrumental value of it, but not exclusively. They're also concerned with the intrinsic value of nature. So it's not as though I would say that the third world, or that particularly India, is occupied with the intrinsic value of nature, whereas the West is concerned with the only instrumental value of nature. But I think it's fairly clear that for the British, the instrumental value of the forest was the only value of the forest, whereas the intrinsic value of the forest was not of interest. Whereas for the Indians themselves, it was both instrumentally important, because they got food, water, fuel, etc., from the forest. But it also has intrinsic value. They adore the forest. They love the forest. They worship the forest. And there are many deities that are understood to reside in the forest, so that the mouth, the source of rivers are always regarded as sacred. So that there's, it's not simply the case that India is concerned with a particular village idea, is concerned only with the inherent value or intrinsic value and not the instrumental value. They're concerned with both. But I think in our civilization, we tend to be more concerned with the instrumental value rather than the intrinsic value of anything.
You mentioned the apartment complexes, I think, where they're building and then they're just dumping waste into the rivers and stuff. It seems to me that would be a fairly simple solution if the government would just pass some laws that said, you have to get a treatment plant to deal with this.
Yeah.
Have they even addressed that?
Oh, yes. There are plans for treatment plants. There have been plans for treatment plants that have been half-built, but funding ran out, sometimes from international resources. Are once engaged with it, then somehow lose interest in it. But there has been plans for another thing is, in Delhi, rather than treating local problems, local issues, cleaning up what are called mullahs, the drains that go into the Yamuna River, the idea is that we're going to go for big technology. So it's going to solve all the problems all at once. But those things just don't quite ever get done. So the problems remain. And so today, the Yamuna River, as it passes through the city of Delhi, is basically a sewer drain. And it remains a sewer drain all the way down to Agra, 3 hours south of Delhi. It smells bad. As it goes past the Taj Mahal, stand on the ramparts of the Taj Mahal, look at the Yamuna River, and it is disgusting. You want to look the other way.
But, you know, there have been plans, but somehow they don't ever seem to. And the more simple solutions, the traditional way of dealing with pollution, particularly water pollution, is regarded as passe and irrelevant, and so that it does.
Is there a point, there's a lot of parallels there between the U.S. Environmental movements and then the problems that they're seeing and rising to. Is there something different over there? Are they using to address their influence to push against progress and this industrialization impact? Are they using religion or culture in a way that we don't do that here? Is there, are there parallels, or is it exactly the same?
Well, it's different. One thing that is the same is that religion gets appropriated by politicians. And of course, there is a movement in Hinduism we could call Hindu right. I have Hindu friends that object to that term. But there's a right-wing movement in Hinduism that basically wants India to be a Hindu culture. India was established as a secular culture in the sense that it believes that all religions should be regarded as equal. That was largely the vision of Nehru. So today there is a great deal of interest. The present Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, is a member of the BJP, which has its roots in the RSS, which was a very enthusiastic Hindu organization that was hostile to every other religious tradition, particularly Islam, and wanted to establish Hinduism as the religion of India. That still is on part of the agenda of the BJP. And Narendra Modi has a great deal of support from right-wing Hindus, just like our present president gets a lot of support from the Hindus, from the Christian right in this country. So there's that similarity. I think we need to be careful about what we're calling progress, because something more technology may not actually be progressive. It may be that traditional ecological knowledge should be more sustainable and should be explored. It should be
but not necessary, so.
Can't be.
This goes with the political thing. India is the world's largest democracy, and each state has its own laws and rules, and there's a certain amount of local. So why can't people just work out what the best thing is for their area? And
well, Hinduism is a very fluid religion.
No, I'm not talking about religion. I'm just talking about the political system.
The local rules.
Yeah, each state can decide themselves whether they want to have, you know, sustainable indigenous type systems, or they want that to become more industrialized or whatever.
Like in America, I mean, one state has a good deal of control over its own resources.
Right.
But it's not as though a state as a whole is going to decide to be green. You know, I mean, it's going to be a political battle regardless of who's involved and what the issues are. It's going to be an issue-by-issue kind of discussion.
Tell that to the people in Oregon and Washington. They don't know they can't be green all by themselves.
They
can't be green all by themselves.
Right, that's true.
Any more? Let's thank our speaker again.
It's been a pleasure to be with you.